Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover Proverbs chapter 25 today, which I will call the Proverbs of Solomon, part 16. We start in verse 1 of Proverbs 25. These also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, transcribed. These Proverbs being referred to here could refer to the Proverbs that follow this verse all the way to the end of the book, as Gill and Clark suggest. Gill suggests that maybe it also refers to all the Proverbs that go before this verse, which I don't believe because of the word also there. These also are Proverbs of Solomon. Some people say this begins a third part of the book. Some say a fourth part, depending on how the book is divided up. I'll leave that to literary critics. I really don't care. I do recall, though, in Proverbs 22, verse 16, that was the last of all the one-line Proverbs that were listed between Proverbs 10 and Proverbs 22, 16. And then for a few verses there in chapter 22, the text switched to instructions. Solomon to his son, telling him how to behave, is a little bit different style. Well, at any rate, these Proverbs that are to come were transcribed by men of Hezekiah. Who were these men? They were either Hezekiah's ministers of state, named Eliakim, Sheban, and Joah, or they might be the prophets of Hezekiah's time, Isaiah, Micah, and Hosea, somebody in the time of Hezekiah, who ruled from 716 BC to 687 BC, transcribed these Proverbs of Solomon. Now, where did they get the Proverbs to Solomon? Well, they could have used Solomon's 3,000 Proverbs. Of course, all of Solomon's Proverbs did not make it into the scripture. These Proverbs could have been stored in the public records of Israel in the temple somewhere. At any rate, they were transcribed. They were not copied from memory. Now, these Proverbs of Solomon probably made it into Hezekiah's time, partly by oral tradition and partly in writing. But at any rate, we begin now with the men of Hezekiah's Proverbs, which originated in King Solomon. Verse 2, Proverbs 25, "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter." Now, there are different ways God can conceal something. He sometimes conceals some things from unbelievers, but reveals these things to believers. For example, Jesus taught in parables so that the Pharisees would be blinded, but the disciples would seek to find out what the truth was. So the believers get truth. Now, that's not exhaustive truth. It's true truth, but it's not exhaustive because obviously believers cannot know everything because there are some things that God conceals from all mankind because the mind of man cannot comprehend the mind of God. So it's the glory of God to conceal a matter because he's so vast and awesome that he can't reveal things to us. He reveals some things to the believer, but not everything. And most of what God is not revealed to anybody. Now, here are some of the things suggested by commentators that God is concealed. For example, a full explanation of the Trinity. Predestination. How does God's predestination fit with man's free will? The eternal generation of the Son. And of course, anytime you study about those doctrines, sooner or later you bump up against mystery. And the theologians always say, well, there's just some things about this we'll never understand. And that's absolutely true. Now, some refer the concealing of God to parables, metaphors, similes, and allegories that God uses in order to conceal some things, not all things, but some things. For example, in Isaiah 45:15, Isaiah says, "Truly, you are a God who hides himself, O God of Israel, Savior." Romans 11:33, Paul says, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways." And that verse was written by someone, Paul, who had received an awful lot of revelation, but he still said God was unsearchable and unfathomable. Of course, that doesn't mean God is completely hidden. He reveals some truth to us, the truths that we need for salvation and sanctification, and our ultimate glorification. Of course, he reveals that, but so much more, especially his workings in history and providence. You look around and you say, how, God, can you put up with this? How, God, can you allow this to happen? God knows what he's doing, and sometimes we can't know. In fact, most of the time, we can't know what he's doing, except in a general fashion. He's establishing his kingdom on earth, and he's preparing the earth as a place for him to dwell with his people, with his redeemed elect. Now, contrasted to God is a king. He's supposed to search out a matter. It's a glory for him to do so. What would a king be searching out? Things perhaps pertaining to civil government. Adam Clark suggests the king is searching out the revelation of God, but I don't think that's what Solomon meant here. He's talking about kings got to know what's going on to do their kingly duty. Job said in Job 29:16, I was a father to the needy, and I investigated the case which I did not know. Job, the patriarch, was probably acting as a judicial judge in some kind of a dispute, and he investigated it. That's what the legal system is supposed to do. It's supposed to find out what the facts. You can't minister justice if you don't know what the facts are. We go to Proverbs 25:3. As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable. Here's what John Gill says about the unsearchable heart of kings. Wise princes lay their schemes deep and conceal their designs and keep their reasons of state secret, so that it is not an easy thing to penetrate into their counsels and views. It was said of the great German chancellor in the Second Reich in the 19th century, Otto von Bismarck, that he deliberately made his foreign policy so complicated that nobody understood what country had made deals with what other country, so that nobody could take his place. Because nobody would know how to operate foreign affairs. They wouldn't know who to talk to, who to keep secrets from. And that is an extreme example. But actually, generally speaking, it is legitimate for princes to keep their designs from the public, because if they let on what they're doing, somebody's going to get killed. For example, if you are a president of the United States, you cannot let the press know where your CIA agents are operating. They're probably down at the local school board looking at parents protesting sexual filth in their children's textbooks, and they're probably reporting back to the president, oh, they're domestic terrorists. But if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, the central government has got to keep its designs a secret from the public, so it's legitimate to do that. However, the unfortunate thing about it is that this secrecy can be used as an excuse for corruption, which, in my opinion, is why it is so incumbent to raise up moral leaders in your country, because they have a lot of power and it can be abused. John Gill says, common persons, therefore, are not proper judges of their leaders, and yet will often take upon them to censor and condemn when they are ignorant of the true cause of such conduct. And I'm sure that's true. We go now to Proverbs 25:4-5. Solomon says, remove impurities from silver, and a vessel will be produced for a silversmith. Remove the wicked from the king's presence, and his throne will be established in righteousness. Now, this is a common metaphor, getting the dross out of silver. We read in Malachi 3:2-3, first part of verse 3. But who can endure the day of his coming, God's coming, and who will be able to stand when God appears? For God will be like a refiner's fire and like cleansing lye. He will be like a refiner and purifier of silver. And the way that works is the silver, which is mixed with dross, is put into a pot, heated up until it melts. And once the silver starts bubbling, the dross bubbles to the top. It's scraped off the top, and behind is pure silver. Of course, the idea is if God is going to refine you, he's got to turn up the heat to get all that nastiness out of your flesh. It's a great metaphor because nobody likes to have the heat turned up on them, but that's what God does to get rid of your flesh. But here it's not talking about refinement of silver as an example of personal sanctification. It's talking about refining the government of a king. Turn up the heat, get rid of the traitors, the gossipers, the backbiters, the morons in your administration, and your throne will be established in righteousness. Proverbs 16:12 says this. Solomon says this. Wicked behavior is detestable to kings, since a throne is established through righteousness. I just read about a Holy Roman Emperor named Maximilian II. He was, if I recall, early 17th century. I might have the dates wrong, but he was a good emperor, and they're rare, and that's why he stuck out in my mind. He was a very good emperor. His throne was established on righteousness. He himself was a righteous man. He was a Christian, dedicated Christian. You don't find leaders like that very often. Their thrones are not established on righteousness. We go now to Proverbs 25:6-7. Do not claim honor in the presence of the king, and do not stand in the place of great men. For it is better that it be said to you, come up here, than for you to be placed lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen. In other words, it would be embarrassing if you tried to get a seat of honor at the king's table, and the king says, no, you're not supposed to sit there. You're supposed to sit way down there, out of my sight. That would be quite embarrassing. Here's what John Gill says of this. Thou shouldest be thrust away with a severe rebuke for thy boldness and arrogance in approaching too near the king's person and taking the place of some great man which did not become thee, and be forced down to a lower place to thy great mortification. I love how Gill uses King James English. At any rate, the point here is, don't try to toot your own horn. Let the king toot it for you. Jesus seems to refer to this passage in Luke 14, verses 8 through 10. When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, give your place to this man. And then in disgrace, you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. Now that's a well-known parable. I think what he's referring to is the Pharisees who are claiming the first seat at God's table. And Jesus is saying, you better be careful. You're going to be pushed out and somebody else is going to be sitting in the honorable seat at the table, namely the Gentile believers, as well as the Jewish believers, but the Pharisees will be gone. I think that's what Jesus is referring to there, but the point is, as a general principle, is don't claim for yourself as your right and your due honor. Let the honor come to you. Don't go seeking for the honor. We're going to read another proverb in this chapter that says the same thing, which I will report on when we get there. Now we go to Proverbs 25, verse 8. Do not go out hastily to argue your case. Otherwise, what will you do in the end when your neighbor humiliates you? Do not go out hastily to argue your case. This is a proverb against litigious people who love to get into lawsuits. And more particularly, it's a proverb against litigious people who go out quickly without getting all their facts together, without seeing if the law is on their side. They just want to get in the courtroom and fight. It seems to me this proverb could also be used against unprepared lawyers. Do not go out, Mr. Attorney Esquire, to argue your case hastily. Don't do that hastily. Get ready for it. I say that because I know that there are a lot of unprepared lawyers for cases. They're overwhelmed. They're constantly putting out fires. But I don't think that's what Solomon's talking about here. He's saying, you need to carefully consider your case before you enter into my courts. First of all, you should consider, are you right or are you wrong? In the modern day, many people just file frivolous nuisance suits to harass other defendants into settling. The attorneys get rich. Everybody else suffers. Nuisance suits are a pain. They're a curse. But at any rate, you shouldn't file a nuisance suit. You should decide you have actually been injured. The next thing you need to consider, can you afford the expense of the suit? Sometimes the injury is less than the cost of the attorney and the attorney's fees and the court fees. So, I remember when I was practicing law, the proverb I always heard was, the only thing worse than going into a lawsuit is dying. There's a lot of truth in that proverb. Otherwise, says Solomon, what will you do in the end when your neighbor humiliates you? The reason you get humiliated is because you weren't prepared. You weren't right. You weren't correct. You had a frivolous cause of action and your neighbor beat you in court. Here's another scripture that's sort of related. Proverbs 3:30. Do not contend with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. In other words, if you're going to go to a lawsuit, make sure you've got a cause. Don't fight with somebody who has not given you a cause to sue him. We go down to Proverbs 25 verses 9 and 10. Argue your case with your neighbor and do not reveal the secret of another, or he who hears it will reproach you, and the evil report about you will not pass away. Now, this neighbor mentioned in verse 9 is called an opponent in the Holman Christian Study Bible. The NASB has neighbor. The Holman Christian Study Bible margin has neighbor. So it's either neighbor or opponent. I'm assuming the neighbor is the opponent. And also, I'm assuming that the neighbor slash opponent is another in the second part of verse 9. Do not reveal the secret of your neighbor. Do not reveal the secret of your opponent. Do not reveal the secret of another. All the same person. The idea here is, Solomon is saying, don't reveal the secrets of your controversy with your neighbor. That would tend to disgrace him. Dirty laundry, as we say. In other words, go to your neighbor first before you go to somebody else and say, my neighbor did this and this and this. He's got his laundry hanging all out of the yard in violation of the local zoning laws. He's got a repair shop in his garage in the back, and violation of the restrictive covenants, and on and on and on. You run him down before you've even gone to talk to your neighbor. You go talk to your neighbor first. Maybe your neighbor said, okay, I'll take down the dirty laundry and I'll move my shop. Let's don't go to court. But if you've talked to everybody else in the neighborhood, now you've made enemies of everybody in the neighborhood, enemies of your neighbor. And of course, your neighbor will then be your enemy, and there will not be peace and harmony. And in addition to that, your neighbors will look at you and think that you have a reputation of spilling secrets and talking bad about neighbors. And then they start thinking, well, maybe he'll say something bad about me. Here's what Adam Clark says about going to law. Oh, the folly of going to law. Oh, the blindness of men and the rapacity of unprincipled lawyers. In other words, talk it out with your neighbor before you go see a lawyer. Now, Clark has got the typical attitude toward lawyers as an ex-lawyer. I appreciate that. I remember a law professor told me once that lawyers have been unpopular since lawyers began. And he quoted a lot of evidence, gave a lot of quotations, and he says, think about this. Why does everybody hate lawyers? Well, two parties are going to go into a lawsuit. One of them is going to lose. That means half of the consuming legal public is going to be angry automatically. And that's not even counting all the people who are angry at their lawyer that represented them. So yes, everybody hates lawyers. And at this point, I feel like telling a lawyer joke. I remember this so well. There was an old news panel discussion show, the McLaughlin Report. And John McLaughlin would sit at the table and he would ask weighty questions of all the journalists sitting around the table. There were about four of them, I think, maybe five. And somebody had shot and killed two lawyers in California near the courthouse. And McLaughlin asked a serious question. He said, do you think this environment of everybody hating lawyers is causing violence to occur because of an atmosphere of violence? And one by one, the learned journalists give their opinions. Yes, I think it's terrible. We say all these bad things about lawyers and people get so upset with them. And now two lawyers have been shot down and gunned and killed in the prime of their life. And on they go. And McLaughlin, like a wise owl, looks at him as they go around. And without cracking a smile, he looks at him. He says, I have another question for you. How is a lawyer like a sperm? Everybody sits there. They're shocked. They don't know what's going on here. And McLaughlin says, I'll tell you. He's got a 1 in 300 billion chance of becoming a human being. He set those journalists up good. I'm still laughing about it 50 years later. We go down to Proverbs 25, verses 11 and 12. Like apples of gold in settings of silver is a word spoken in right circumstances. Like an earring of gold in an ornament of fine gold is a wise reprover to a listening ear. So verse 11 is about speaking wise things, and verse 12 is about listening to wise things. And of course, a listening ear is a good thing, and a wise reprover is a good thing. Speak wisdom to those who are willing to hear wisdom. Now, in verse 11, the metaphor is this. The wise words that are spoken are like apples of gold, but they've got to be set in something pretty before those apples of gold will really be valuable as golden apples, and that would be a setting of silver, a background of silver. Likewise, you can speak a right word that's like a golden apple, but if you don't have the background for it, the silver setting for it, then your words aren't going to be any good. Now, John Gill suggests the right circumstances that Solomon mentions for this word of wisdom to be spoken. The matter, the method, the time, the place, and the right persons all need to be right. The matter that's spoken about, for example, you've got somebody that's engaged in some trivial personal defect. Everybody's got these. Just let it go. It's not worth talking about. The method of reproving. You don't go up to somebody and say, you are a real SOB. You know that, don't you? Also, do you do it face-to-face? Do you do it written by letter? And of course, in the modern age, you've got other options like email, phone chat, SMS chat. Usually, it's better to do it face-to-face if you can. The time of the reproof. Do you reprove somebody right after he does something wrong when he's not willing to hear it? For example, I had a relative one time that was flying a twin-engine plane and forgot to put his landing gear down when he landed. And of course, that does a number on the props, probably wrecked the engine, sparks fly everywhere, it probably scared him to death. And so the investigator who came to investigate says, why didn't you put your wheels down? And my relative who was telling me the story said, well, you know, I knew I was supposed to put the wheels down. I just forgot. I didn't need to be told by him that I made a mistake in putting the wheels down. That was obvious, and it irritated him, as I can imagine. So do you give the reproof at the right time, at the right place? Do you reprove the person in public, or do you do it in private? Do you reprove the right persons, the people involved in the matter? You don't go talking about it to other people and so forth. So here's what Adam Clark says about a wise reproof like an apple of gold. It's an observation, caution, reproof, or advice that comes in naturally, runs smoothly along, is not forced nor dragged in, that appears to be without design, to rise out of the conversation, and though particularly relative to one point, will appear to the company to suit all. Well, that takes a lot of skill. It reminds me of a situation. Clark's comment here reminds me of a situation where a rebuke was given to a whole congregation of a church. Everybody knew what the rebuked person had done. And so the pastor gets up and he says, without mentioning the guilty party's name, he says, this is what ought not to be done, blah, 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 blah. And everybody knew he was referring to one person. Well, that's not what you do. That's not an apple of gold in a setting of silver. Clark is saying, if you're going to do that, make the exhortation appear, the rebuke appear to suit everybody in the crowd that's listening, not just one person. At any rate, it takes a lot of wisdom to do this. Now, that's the talking of wisdom. Let's look at the receiving of wisdom in verse 12. A listening ear has an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold on it. I'm going to assume the earring of gold is the ornament of fine gold, and I'm going to assume a feminine ear because, except for some people, most men do not wear these heavy, big golden earrings. They might wear these little tiny earrings these days, but not a big earring of gold. And so this ear is a beautiful ear, and that's a symbol of an ear that's willing to listen. Here's some other scriptures, Proverbs 9, 8 through 9. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. In other words, reprove a man with an ear, or a woman with an ear with a nice earring on it. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase his learning. Proverbs 15:31, Solomon says, he whose ear listens to the life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. So to summarize, in verse 11, the spoken word is like gold, and in verse 12, the listening ear is like gold. So, for good correction to come, words must be spoken rightly and listened to rightly. We go now to Proverbs 25:13. Like the cold of snow in the time of harvest is a faithful messenger to those who send him, for he refreshes the soul of his masters. Solomon was constantly worried about faithful messengers. I think he was concerned with his diplomatic envoys. They probably caused him a lot of trouble, like all diplomats. If they screw up, they really cause a lot of trouble. Now, this cold of snow in the time of harvest, usually it doesn't snow in the time of harvest, so why would cold snow be being brought to harvest workers? Well, it was used to cool drinks, and the drink would refresh the workers. This is from Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Clark makes the comment that snow was frequent in Judea, and that's well known, and that in the east they have snow houses, places dug underground, where they lay up snow for summer use. That's also a fact. By means of the mass of snow deposited in them, the icy temperature is kept up so that the snow is easily preserved, all before refrigeration. Very refreshing. It even sounds refreshing. Solomon also says in this chapter, chapter 25, verse 25, like cold water to a weary soul, so is good news from a distant land. Cold water to a tired and panting and thirsty soul. Cold water tastes so good. So if a king sends out a diplomat, a messenger, and finds out that the messenger delivered the message properly, well, it makes him happy. It makes the king happy. His soul, the master's soul, is refreshed. Here's another similar proverb by Solomon in Proverbs 13:17. A wicked messenger falls into adversity, but a faithful envoy brings healing. We go down to Proverbs 25:14. Like clouds and wind without rain is a man who boasts of his gifts falsely. Now, at first blush, this proverb sounds like Solomon is complaining about men who boast about gifts that they don't really have. They're braggadocious. That's not what it means. It means Solomon is complaining about men who promise to give gifts, but then they don't give them. They boast of their gifts falsely. Here's some other translations that might make it clearer. Proverbs 25:14, like clouds and wind without rain is one who boasts of gifts never given. And here's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. The man who boasts about a gift that does not exist is like clouds and wind without rain. Now, if you look at a cloud and the wind will be blowing at the same time, a storm's about to come, but then it never rains. We see that a lot in the weather, even in our time. Well, you look at the cloud, you think you're going to get some rain, but then it doesn't come. Same idea. You listen to a man talk about the man's going to give you a gift, and then it never comes. Here's some New Testament scriptures that have mention of clouds without water. 2 Peter 2, verses 17 through 18. These are springs without water and mist driven by a storm. A spring is like a cloud. You look at it, you expect water, but then there's no water there. And mist are like foggy, misty rain that you expect to create rain, but it never comes. For whom the black darkness has been reserved, these false heretics that Peter's talking about, for speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error. So the clouds without water are like these false teachers who promise truth and they give nothing. Jude 1:12, these are the men who are hidden reefs in your love feast when they feast with you without fear, caring for themselves. Clouds without water, there's that metaphor again, carried along by winds. They look like they're going to nourish you, but they don't. So I guess the lesson learned is don't make promises you can't fulfill. It reminds me of the time I was a business professor at a small liberal arts college. And the president of the college came to me in the cafeteria one day and said, Dan, we're getting ready to build a brand new business administration building. This, of course, was to entice me to be happy and to stay at the college. Well, the building never showed up. Instead, a big new library was built, and the business department remained without a building, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of students were business students, and the overwhelming amount of money that was brought into the college came from business students, but we still didn't have our own building, which is all right. It didn't bother me that much, but I remember him promising something and not delivering on it, and it happened all the time. And so pretty soon you just say, yep, a word from the administration. We'll take that one with a ton of salt. So if you're going to make promises, fulfill them. If you can't fulfill them, don't make the promise. We go now to Proverbs 25:15. By forbearance, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. Now, here's some scriptural examples where wills were bent with soft words. Remember when Saul was chasing David? David caught him in a cave at En Gedi on the west coast of the Dead Sea. This is what David said to Saul. 1 Samuel 24, verses 11 through 12. See, my father, look at the corner of your robe in my hand, for I cut it off, but I didn't kill you. Look and recognize that there is no evil or rebellion in me. I have not sinned against you, even though you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord take vengeance on you for me. But my hand will never be against you. Very soft words. And of course, Saul relented and said, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. Now, that was true for that particular incident, but we know that sooner or later, Saul still came after David anyway. His soft words didn't work forever, but they did work in that instance. Now, another time when soft words turned away wrath was when Abigail turned away David's wrath when David was getting ready to kill Abigail's husband, Nabal, whose name means fool. You recall the story. David had provided protection with his little band of mercenaries and protected Nabal's sheep, but then David was not invited to the sheep shearing festival, and David thought that was quite impolite and rude, and so he says, I'm going to go kill that guy. Abigail runs out to meet him, and this is what she says in 1 Samuel 25, verses 27 through 28. Accept this gift your servant has brought to my lord, and let it be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive your servant's offense, for the Lord is certain to make a lasting dynasty for my lord, because he fights the Lord's battles. Throughout your life may evil not be found in you. And those soft words of Abigail did turn away David's wrath. In fact, David ended up marrying Abigail. Here's some other scriptures that talk about bridling one's tongue, soft answer. Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Proverbs 15:18, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger calms a dispute. Proverbs 14:29, he who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. Proverbs 16:32, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city. Proverbs 29:11, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Proverbs 12:16, a fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. Proverbs 14:17, a quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. Proverbs 29:22, an angry man stirs up strife, and a hot-tempered man abounds in transgression. So the moral of that proverb is, hold your temper in check. Anger management. A soft tongue breaks the bone. A bone's hard, a tongue is soft, but nonetheless, ironically and paradoxically, the soft tongue will break the bone. We go down to Proverbs 25:16. Solomon asks, have you found honey? Eat only what you need, that you not have it in excess and vomit it. Now, how to interpret this proverb? Maimonides and John Gill, Maimonides being the 11th century famous Jewish scholar. I think he was 11th century. He says, and Gill says, don't try to get too much wisdom and knowledge. Don't aim for things that are too high and above your capacity. So honey is nice. A little bit of wisdom is nice, but don't think you can get too much of it. That's reasonable, I guess. Adam Clark suggests rather that it's moderation in the use of worldly things that's sweet like honey. But too much use of worldly things will end up making you vomit. Well, that's true. Not a bad interpretation. Jameson Fawcett Brown looks at the next verse, which is about not visiting your neighbor too much. And Jameson Fawcett Brown say that if you excessively visit your neighbor, it will be like eating honey in excess and vomiting the honey. Don't enjoy too much of your neighbor's hospitality, they say. Well, let's look at some other honey proverbs. Proverbs 25:27. It is not good to eat much honey, nor is it glory to search out one's own glory. Now, that's verse 27. We'll get to that in just a minute. There's a translation problem in that verse. But the first part is clear. It is not good to eat much honey. Don't eat too much of it. Proverbs 24:13. My son, eat honey, for it is good. Yes, the honey from the comb is sweet to your taste. So it's all right for sweet things in life, but oftentimes, too much honey will kill you, make you sick. Money is nice, too much money. How many people do you know that have been pierced with many a pang to their own destruction because they've got too much money and they love it and they want more? We go now to Proverbs 25:17. Solomon says, let your foot rarely be in your neighbor's house, or he will become weary of you and hate you. As we say in English, don't overstay your welcome. We have some proverbs similar to this. Too much familiarity breeds contempt. How about this one? Good fences produce good neighbors. Don't go over there too much. I've even got a Chinese one, Juli Shengchan Yomei, which means distance produces beauty. I like that one. Distance produces beauty. We go down to Proverbs 25:18. Solomon says, like a club and a sword and a sharp arrow is a man who bears false witness against his neighbor. Take a club, go next door and beat somebody over the head with it, beat your neighbor over the head, then take a sword and run him through, and then take a bow and arrow and pull the bow back and launch an arrow into his gut. That's the same thing as lying about your neighbor in court, or maybe not even in court. I'm sure that when you see false witness, you're talking about perjury in court. Solomon is constantly worried about that. But even if you're just slandering somebody not in court, you're killing him. That old proverb, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me, is a lie. Words can be very damaging. Solomon says in Proverbs 24:28, do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause, and do not deceive with your lips. Don't lie about your neighbor if you don't have a reason to say something bad about him. Now, if you've got a cause, you might need to take him to court, and then, of course, you could be a witness against him then, but don't just make up things about your neighbor. Serious business. Proverbs 25:19, like a bad tooth and an unsteady foot, Solomon says, is confidence in a faithless man in time of trouble. An unsteady foot is like a foot out of joint, as the King James has it. The NIV has a lame foot, like a bad tooth and a lame foot. Bad teeth hurt, and lame feet keep you from walking. So they don't give you a lot of confidence. So you give your confidence to a faithless man in a time of trouble, and that faithless man is going to desert you. It's probably when the faithless man has run. The time of trouble is when the faithless man runs, because things are not going well. In other words, your advisors, your confidants are important. You don't need faithless people. And that's why even in church work, you need people around you. Look at all these big shot evangelical teachers on the internet writing books. They all have people around them that support them. Sometimes you know about them because they're mentioned, but usually they're not mentioned too much. Sometimes they'll have a substitute teaching or they'll put something on the internet and put their name behind it. Sometimes it's just people in the local churches of these big shots that support them. Everybody needs faithful men backing them up. We go now to Proverbs 25, verse 20. Like one who takes off a garment on a cold day, or like vinegar on soda, is he who sings songs to a troubled heart. Well, let's look at the metaphors that talk about unpleasant situations, taking off a garment on a cold day. I keep my house very cold at night. I wear 3 or 4 sweaters and 2 sweatpants, as well as other pants, sometimes some insulated underwear that I bought in northern China where it was really cold. And so I wear this at night, turn the heat down real low, and then when I get up in the morning, oh gosh, and I got to go to the restroom and I got to take the clothes off. Oh my gosh, it's so unpleasant. Or how about vinegar on soda? Vinegar, of course, is acidic. Soda is base, and you add an acid to a base, you get a reaction which produces water, and that reaction is something that grabs your attention. It's unpleasant. Psst! The thing boils. It's interesting, the Holman Christian Study Bible note for soda says that the word literally is natron, N-A-T-R-O-N, which I don't know what that is. Natron or sodium carbonate. I know what sodium carbonate is, so I don't know how the scholars figured out that this was soda that the ancient Hebrews were using, but I'll take their word for it. So at any rate, these two situations, taking a garment off on a cold day or mixing vinegar and soda, produces unpleasantness, the same sort of unpleasantness that someone who is troubled experiences when somebody cheerfully comes to him and sings songs to him. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3:4, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. You come up to somebody that's hurting and is going through a trial and you say, oh, everything's okay. I know how you feel, buddy. Woo, think the weather's great today, isn't it? People don't like to hear that when they're hurting. Your motive might be good doing that, but the results are not. One should never try to cheer one up with words or actions that don't relate to the person's condition. The person's just lost a loved one and you're talking about how beautiful the weather is, and singing songs might make the suffering person feel that you are nonchalant and non-caring. You're not serious. You don't understand what I'm going through now. So this is a very good proverb. Feel sympathy with and let people ventilate to you. Don't get up there and try to cheer them up with some silly song or some silly trite aphorism. Listen to them. Now, I thought of what might be a counterexample. Remember, David sang to Saul when Saul was tormented by an evil spirit. Well, actually, he played the lyre, and I assume he sang too. So is when David sings songs or plays songs to the troubled heart of Saul, is he not violating this proverb? Well, I think we can distinguish that. Saul was not grieving. He was demonized. In 1 Samuel 16:14, we read, now the spirit of the Lord had left Saul, and an evil spirit sent from the Lord began to torment him. And not only that, David's songs were not necessarily cheerful ones. They might have been slow, soft, easy songs trying to calm the demon down in Saul. So I don't think David is contradicting Solomon here in Proverbs 25:20. We go now to Proverbs 25, verses 21 and 22. Solomon says, if your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat, and if he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. First of all, we need to point out that the enemy here is a personal enemy. This is not an exhortation by Solomon to heads of government. Oh, you've got an enemy? They're invading your country. Give him some food. That is not what Solomon is talking about. This is not state action. Otherwise, you'd end up with extreme pacifism. And anybody that is a government official who will not protect his country, and that's what a pacifist would be if, God forbid, they ever got to be head of a country, then the results would be disastrous. So Solomon can't be talking about that. He's talking about personal enemies. Now, this verse was quoted by the Apostle Paul in Romans 12, verse 20. Paul says, but if your enemy is hungry, feed him, and if he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. This is what Adam Clark says about this. So has God dealt with you? And has not a sense of his goodness and long-suffering towards you been a means of melting down your heart into penitential compunction, gratitude, and love towards him? How know you that a similar conduct towards your enemy may not have the same gracious influence on him towards you? Your kindness may be the means of begetting in him a sense of his guilt, and from being your fell enemy, he may become your real friend. Now, that's true. It's not a guarantee. The results are not guaranteed that your enemy will be nice to you, but nonetheless, we're still commanded privately to love our enemies, to not get angry at enemies, to not take revenge on them. Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:44. But I say to you, love your enemies, Jesus says, and pray for those who persecute you. The church in America is getting ready to get persecuted by the Antichrist woke left. We need to pray for those guys on the woke left and pray that they see the error of their ways. Give them food and water, this proverb says. Give your enemies food and water, of course. That represents all the necessities of life. Now again, this is private enemies. It's not referring to public enemies. I mentioned governments having public enemies, but Jesus had public enemies too. He didn't give food and water to the Pharisees. He let them hold it. Paul didn't give food and water to his legalist opponents in Galatia. And rather, in fact, he wished that they were castrated. When you're doing ideological battle or philosophical battle, you don't hand over the store to your enemies. This is talking about when you got a private grievance with somebody. Don't think about how you're going to take them to court and you're going to get vengeance. I just saw a great true story movie about a little baby girl was born in Harlem, and a woman who had three miscarriages and couldn't have a child kidnapped that baby and raised the baby 45 miles away in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Carlina White was the baby's original name. And at the age of 23, Carlina White had grown up, and she used the internet and found out who her real parents were. So they had a reunion. And then later in the press, Joy White, the mother of Carlina, the mother who had had the baby stolen away from her, said that she wished nothing but evil on that woman who had stolen the baby. She wanted her to suffer every bit as much as she suffered over the last 23 years. Now, folks, it's understandable. You got a baby stolen from you. That's a pretty horrible thing. But revenge will eat you up. And I was sorry to see that, because it looked like the true birth mother was in a Christian family, according to the movie. They were praying all the time and quoting Jesus. And in fact, her mother even said, "We forgive this woman who stole the baby." The grandmother said that, but not the mother. So the idea is you forgive people and you're nice to your enemies. It's like heaping burning coals on his head. That means he will not come to hurt you anymore, because nobody wants to have burning coals put on their head. Now, this brings up another interesting point. Could it be that if we feed our enemy and make him feel bad, that we have a bad motive in doing that? We're saying, I'm going to heap burning coals on my enemy. I'm going to be nice to him. But deep down in my heart, I really want him to feel bad about what I'm doing. Oh no, that's not allowed. The reason we would give food and water to our enemies is to bring the enemy to repentance. As John Gill says, not to do him hurt, not to aggravate his condemnation, as if this would be a means of bringing down the wrath of God more fiercely on him, which is a sense given by some. So some people have had the same idea I had. This is a good way to get back at our enemies. Get some coals on their head. Just be nice to them. But that's not what is meant here, at least as John Gill believes, and I agree with him. As if giving food and water would be a means of bringing down the wrath of God the more fiercely on him, Gill continues, which is a sense given by some, as if this would be an inducement to the saints to do such acts of kindness, which is just the reverse of the spirit and temper of mind that the apostle here is here cultivating. But rather the sense is that by so doing, the enemy's conscience would be stung with a sense of former injuries done to his benefactor, and he'd be filled with shame on account of them and be brought to repentance for them and to love the person he before hated and be careful of doing him any wrong for the future. We go down to Proverbs 25:23. The north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue and angry countenance. Well, I can imagine a north wind bringing rain, storm clouds, and so forth. And I can imagine that being compared to listening to a backbiting tongue bringing forth an angry countenance and looking at the angry face. As a matter of fact, the pulpit commentary says that north winds in Palestine do bring rain. More precisely, the northwest wind does bring rain into the country. Now, this backbiting tongue, the NIV says a sly tongue, brings forth an angry countenance. The KJV has backbiting as well as the NASB. And so the moral of this proverb is keep your speech sweet and don't quarrel and quibble and say nasty things about people. And keep your face pleasant. Don't let it have anger on it all the time. We go now to Proverbs 25:24. Solomon says, it is better to live in a corner of the roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. Now, I've quoted these Proverbs many times. I'll do it again. And we need to remember that Solomon says some great things about godly women. And in fact, it's not Solomon, but Proverbs 31. There's a whole chapter devoted to an excellent wife. So there are godly women mentioned by Solomon in Proverbs. But it's these nasty ones that stand out. I read these Proverbs and I think about all these YouTube short videos I'm watching now of Generation Z people jumping all over feminists. And these Generation Z people are women jumping all over feminists and saying, this is not what men want. They don't want a woman who's always griping and complaining. You don't make enough money and it's all your fault and I'm going to go out and find myself. And I want to be equal in this household, but I want you to pay all the bills. And they go on and on mocking present-day feminists. There's no wonder that nobody's getting married anymore. Men don't want to put up with it. So let me read the Proverbs. Proverbs 21:9, it is better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. Roofs back then were flat, and in a corner you would have the balustrade around the corner, which would give a place where you could actually live. Out there in the open, if you put a tent over your head, I guess it'd keep the weather off of you. Get away from that woman downstairs who's nag, 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 nag. Proverbs 21:19, it is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. Proverbs 17:1, better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Proverbs 19:13, a foolish son is destruction to his father, and the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping. Proverbs 27:15, a constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. The drip never stops, and the woman's quarrelsome words never stop. Gentlemen, avoid such a wife as that, or you will be totally and utterly miserable. We go now to Proverbs 25, verse 25. Solomon says, like cold water to a weary soul, so is good news from a distant land. That reminds us of the verse we just looked at, verse 13 in this chapter 25. Like the cold of snow in the time of harvest is a faithful messenger. Well, that cold snow is delivered to workers in the harvest in verse 13. In verse 25, it's like cold water to a weary soul. We can imagine workers in the field, in the hot field. Oh, boy, when you get hot and you've been working outside in the sun, especially in the South Carolina sun, and it's so hot that you are walking around in a haze and a fog, and you're panting like a dog, and somebody brings you a nice glass of ice water. Oh, does it taste good? Got to be careful. If you're too hot and drink cold water, it can give you a stroke. But anyway, the point is it tastes so good. And just like that cold water tastes good, so does it feel good to get good news from a distant land. Now, Solomon's a king. He probably heard that, oh, we won a battle. Our troops won. Whatever. Oh, another nation from far off is going to send us tribute. Oh, they were late on their tribute, but now the tribute's coming. That kind of thing. I know when I get good news from China, those people are suffering, the church is suffering so bad over there, I can't stand to think about that. I don't like that. But then when I hear, for example, they got rid of that idiotic COVID zero policy and they're not being locked up in their apartments anymore after all the riots spread all over the country, that was good news because I expected the government to go in there with machine guns and start shooting people, but they didn't. They backed off. We go now to Proverbs 25:26. Like a trampled spring and a polluted well is a righteous man who gives way before the wicked. Well, a spring that is trampled is like a beautiful spring with fresh water coming out of it, being subjected to people with muddy boots, and they go stomping on the spring and stirring up the mud, and pretty soon that clear spring is producing nothing but muddy water, just like a polluted well produces water with all kinds of bugs in it. Green stuff, slime, a great thing to compare this righteous man who gives way before the wicked. A compromiser, a wussy-pussy evangelical. Oh, we're not going to talk about gay rights. We're not going to talk about sodomy being considered as marriage. We're not going to talk about slicing up babies in their mother's wombs and throwing them away in trash bags in the hospital alley. Because we might get our tax-exempt status taken away. We're not going to talk about a government and a hospital system that takes little kids, little girls, and gives them double mastectomies because the little girl thinks she wants to be a man, either because of some perverted parent or because of some perverted school teacher who doesn't tell the parent. We're not going to say anything about that. They're too powerful. They control the tax system. They control the government. Some of these woke people might come and protest against us. Well, people like that, they don't deserve to be preachers, that's for sure. They're like a trampled spring with muddy water in the spring and a polluted well full of bugs and toxic chemicals. Here's how John Gill describes such a compromiser, the way he gives way before the wicked, crouching unto him, crouching unto the wicked, bowing before him, yielding to him, not daring to oppose or reprove him, or falling into sin in his presence, which he ever after reproaches him for, and openly exposes him so that his usefulness is lost. And I'm talking real big now in the privacy of my home, but I'll tell you, if you're in front of a situation where that person has power and you stand up to them and they can throw you in jail, that's a hard thing to do. But you look in the scriptures, you don't see people giving away before the wicked. You see people speaking truth to power, like Peter and John before the Sanhedrin, for chapter 4, chapter 5, I forgot where, I think it's 4. We can't stop talking about what we saw, guys, so you do what you're going to do, but we're going to keep preaching the gospel. Go now to Proverbs 25, verse 27. It is not good to eat much honey, nor is it glory to search out one's own glory. Now, let me give you a couple of other honey scriptures. I've done this previously. In verse 16, we just covered that. Have you found honey? Eat only what you need, that you not have it in excess and vomit it. So that's a warning against eating too much honey. And then Proverbs 24:13, my son, eat honey, for it is good. That's an exhortation to enjoy some sweet. Yes, the honey from the comb is sweet to your taste. Now, the first part of verse 27 is easy to interpret. It is not good to eat much honey because it'll make you sick. It's just like everything. Moderation is great. I mean, I used to, before I had to quit eating it, love popcorn. But I tell you, you eat enough popcorn. How about a potato chip? You eat one. I've eaten a whole bag of potato chips before. I'm sure it probably took 5 years off my life. And it probably prepared my gut to bulge the way it's bulging now. That first potato chip was good, but boy, you eat a whole bag of them. That's not good. Now, some have interpreted the honey as referring to getting knowledge. It is not good to eat much honey. In other words, trying to get too much honey, trying to get too much knowledge for which you're not prepared for or not capable of is going to get you sick. That might be. I prefer to think of it just as an application of the verse. Now, let's look at the second part of verse 27. Nor is it glory to search out one's own glory. That's the NASB. Now, there's a translation issue here, and this is what Adam Clark says about the last part of the verse. He that searches too much into mysteries is likely to be confounded by them. All right, that's one interpretation. Nor is it glory to search out one's own glory, nor is it glory to search out for too much wisdom. That's a rough possibility. Clark continues, I really think this is the meaning of the place here, and I shall not puzzle either myself or my reader with the discordant explanations which have been brought forward with the hope of illustrating this passage. In other words, Clark gives his opinion. He knows that he might be wrong, and he's not going to bother with all the opinions that have been brought forth about what this verse means. Well, let's look at some other translations that are like the NASB. Nor is it glory to search out one's own glory. The ASV, American Standard Version, says, so for men to search out their own glory is grievous. That's basically what the NASB says. And the interpretation would be, it's all right to get some glory, but if you go looking for it, that's not good. And that's how I'm going to interpret it, because this is the majority translation, I think. God's Word translation says this, eating too much honey is not good, and searching for honor is not honorable. Again, don't go out looking for honor. There's a lot of people in this world who love to get honor. They want to sit at the chief spots of the table like the Pharisees did. They want their name up on the college buildings. They want to run for office and be a big shot politician. The KJV translates the verse this way. It is not good to eat much honey, so for men to search their own glory is not glory. Same idea. Don't go looking for glory. That's simple enough. But let's look at some other translations that are different than the NASB. Here's the Holman Christian Study Bible. It is not good to eat too much honey or to seek glory after glory. Now, that's similar to the NASB. The person is seeking more and more and more glory, glory after glory. But the Holman Christian Study Bible margin says the phrase there is literally seek their glory, comma, glory. Seek their glory, comma, glory. So literally it would be like this. It is not good to eat too much honey or to seek their glory, glory. Well, what does that mean? You see why Adam Clark said that this was somewhat difficult. Here's what the NAB, the New American Bible, says. To eat too much honey is not good, nor to seek honor after honor, which is similar to the Holman Christian Study Bible. And again, the idea there is very similar to the NASB, to keep looking for glory and then look for more glory. It's not good. You're looking for too much glory. Here's the Bible in basic English. It is not good to take much honey, so he who is not looking for honor will be honored. Now, that's the same idea as the NASB expressed in a negative fashion. The NASB says, don't go looking after glory after glory. And the Bible in basic English says, if you're not looking for glory, you're going to be honored anyway. Now, Darby has an interesting translation, Proverbs 25:27. It is not good to eat much honey, and to search into weighty matters is itself a weight. Now, that's a stretch. Well, we're just going to take it to mean, don't go looking for glory. Don't go looking for honor. Well, we're just going to take it to mean, don't go looking for glory. Don't go looking for honor. If you get some, that's fine. But you go looking for it, you're going to ruin yourself. It is not glorious to go panning after glory like a dog in heat. We go now to Proverbs 25:28, and we will finish this chapter. Like a city that is broken into and without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit. Again, this is one of these anti-temper proverbs that Solomon gives us. This is what Gill says about this man who is compared to a broken city, into which they may go, meaning the enemies of the city, into which they may go with pleasure, and which is exposed to the rapine and violence of everyone. And so a man that has no command of himself and passions, but gives the reins to them, is exposed to the enemy of souls. Gives the reins to them means you say, giddy up, let's go. His horses are passions, evil passions, and so he says to his passions, giddy up, giddy up, giddy up, let's get out of here. This person is exposed to the enemy of souls, Satan, and is liable to every sin, snare, and temptation. With that solemn exhortation, we are now finished with Proverbs 25, and we are prepared to go to Proverbs 26 in our next audio, which I will call Proverbs of Solomon, Part 17. I hope you stay tuned for some more wisdom, and I hope you enjoyed this chapter.